Welcome to The Appleseed, the storytelling podcast from BYU Radio, where your family can gather for great stories from great storytellers in every episode. Stories bring us together, and the stories on the show will spark memories and thoughts that you can share with the people you love. And on today's episode of The Appleseed, the stories you hang on to, the ones you remember and share, are the things that help you understand the way your life is unfolding, and they can help other people understand, too. Those stories provide for you a picture of yourself, that person who has experienced such good times and bad times, that person who has found solutions to all kinds of problems, overcome all kinds of challenges, a person that is like all your human brothers and sisters in some ways and totally unique in other ways. Now, remembering and sharing the tales that make up that amazing picture is what this first story is all about. The storyteller is Paul Strickland, and though the story is a made-up fable that takes place in the Big Fib Trailer Park cul-de-sac, the fictional place where a lot of Paul's stories take place, you'll hear some true things, too, things you'll want to remember about the power that remembering and sharing stories can have in the life of a person or a family. Here's Paul with a tale called The Oneabouts, right here on The Appleseed.
Let's do a story about the power of stories then, shall we? When I was 23 years old was the first time I went down to visit my Aunt True and my Uncle False on my own without my parents in my own car. And for those of you who do not know, my Aunt True and Uncle False live in a trailer park called Big Fib Trailer Park Cul-de-Sac. It's a trailer park in the shape of a giant cul-de-sac in a town called Big Fib. And Big Fib is way down south of anywhere. I mean, it's down there off the coast of Factual. In fact, if you leave Factual and you head due south, you will pass Big Fib on your way to Bald-Faced. And obviously, if you get to Bald-Faced, then you have gone too far. So I went down there at 23 years old, and I was down there for 3 nights, and there are things in life that you know that you just do not know that you know until you know that you know them. Like, you knew it the whole time, you just didn't know that you already knew it, right? Like, y'all have never been to Big Fib, but here's something you already know about Big Fib. Big Fib, not known for its nightlife. I was down there at 23 years old, and on the third night, I was kind of bored out of my mind. And anytime you're bored, it's at least half your fault. But I was bored, and I said to Aunt True, I said, Aunt True, is there something that a young fella could go do on an evening in this town? And Aunt True said, oh, honey, yeah, you know what you could do? You could walk around the trailer park and see how many of the neighbors have motion sensor lights. Four. But when I got back from the evening's activity, Uncle False was standing there waiting on me. He said, hey, boy, listen here. You ain't true nice talking. Thought it was time for you to learn about the oneabouts. But they are in a box in the shed that is under my can change and my collection of back scratchers. Okay, we'll get to the can change in a second. I said, Uncle False, you have a collection of back scratchers. Uncle False said, yeah, about 200 or so. You know, they're less heavy to move than they are awkward. Aunt True said, is it more awkward to move it, honey, or that you still have it? Uncle False said, here's what happened, Paul. Aunt True and I were talking. I've been searching for the perfect back scratcher for years now. You understand? The perfect back scratcher. I'd go out, I'd buy everyone I would see. They're only a quarter, so I'd buy one, I'd bring it home, I'd try it out, you know? It wouldn't be quite right. And you know how I am, I just kind of leave them around the trailer. Well, you know how I am, honey. I have trouble sleeping. And whenever I'm not sleeping well, I like to walk around for my circulation. And let me tell you what you do not want to discover at 3 a.m. whenever you're half awake walking around your own trailer is 13 dozen little hands. Uncle False said, so she made me collect them all, put them in a box, put them in the shed, and then she suggested that I start scratching my back on the door frame, which I had never heard of before. Paul, would you? It was the back scratching I had always been searching for. Do you understand what that means, boy? That means that the Moby Dick of back scratchers came on my trailer pre-installed. I walked out to the shed, and I'm glad I did, Because that box of back scratchers was awkward. I mean, it really was. It's long, has like duct tape on all eight corners. So when you move it off, it's shifting and moving. So it just feels like those back scratchers in there are all searching for the Moby Dick of backs. It's just awful. But I got that thing off of there. And then the next four boxes were really heavy. They were the canned change. And I mean, they were exceptionally heavy. So I set one down and I pulled one of them out. And it's exactly what you think when I say canned change. It's a glass jar with American currency quarters in it, in water, pressure cook sealed. Canned change. And the one I pulled out had a date on it. It said October 1967. I said, "Ain't true. What is this about?" She said, "Oh, well, baby, you know how green beans or whatnot, they'll deteriorate over time if you don't can them. Well, the collective inflation rate from back in those times till now is sometimes up to 500%. I said, "Ain't true. Is that really how that works?" She said, "Well, honey, turn around." And she flipped on a light. And in the back of the shed, up on clotheslines, clothespinned up, hundreds of dollar bills. Just hundreds of dollar bills in the back of the shed. I turned back around, Aunt True said, "That was from a jar that was marked September of 1961. Here's what happened. Your Uncle Faults and I, we get a jar, and when we determine that every quarter in that jar is worth exactly $2 in today's money, we do the math, you understand? I do the math, right? Your Uncle Faults moves his fingers around, but baby, at our age, exercise is exercise. So I do the math, and then we open that jar when we think every quarter in there is worth exactly $2, and we dump it out. And if we're right, when the modern air hits them quarters, pow, pow, they explode into two wet little dollar bills. I mean, it sounds like we're making popcorn out here, baby, but listen, we knew, your Uncle Faults and I knew, if we were ever going to get to retire, we were going to have to get real creative. Well, we found the box of the whatabouts. And the whatabouts are just, you know, those old the analog photo albums that crackled whenever you open them? In the whatabouts, there are no photos. It's just index cards. And on each one of those index cards are the words, "the whatabout," and then the rest of the title of that story. And then some crossed out names, and hopefully a name that has not yet been crossed out. So, Ain't True asked me to pull one. And the first one I ever pulled, the first one about I ever pulled, it was the one about how Grandpa Joe lost all his money. And Ain't True said, "Oh, well, honey, in order to know about the one about how my Grandpa Joe lost all his money, you need to know about the city of Whelm." Now, do y'all know about the city of Whelm? It's a historical story. It's America's most recently organically formed city. Franklin Delano Roosevelt's New Deal. Construction was just booming everywhere. And there was this one construction crew that was building a road to ostensibly a place that people would want to go. But the foreman of this construction crew was one of these people that refuses to look at maps, refuses to ask for directions. So this construction crew ended up building this road 28 miles off course before the entire crew asked the foreman, did he know where they were going? And he admitted he did not, and the crew mutinied and murdered him. History is not always kind. They buried him in a shallow grave right at the point where that road ceased to exist, but they were a good crew, safety first. They erected a sign there that simply said, "Dead End." And to this day, people argue over whether or not irony was intended, but none of this the point. The point is that families in station wagons ended up following this accidental, unintended, nameless road to nowhere. So many families in so many station wagons took this unintended, nameless road to nowhere, got all the way to that dead end sign, realized they don't have enough gas to get back, so they just had to sadly build a house. And that is how the city of Whelm came to be. And because of the way it was formed, it was instantly populated and instantly successful. Suburbs began to crop up immediately. North of Whelm was Overwhelm. South of Whelm was Underwhelm. West of Whelm was Not a Pun. A lot of people prefer to live in Not a Pun, I have found. My Aunt True's Grandpa Joe and Grandma Inez and their 10-year-old boy, who would later grow up to be my Aunt True's daddy, they found themselves at this unintended, nameless road to nowhere. Now, they had a map, friends. They had a map, but like a lot of families at that time, they were kind of hopeless feeling. They were feeling kind of desperate. And listen, when you've got a map that seems hopeless and desperate, a road that ain't on that map seems like a great idea. So they took that unintended nameless road to nowhere, and they ended up in Whelm, where they started searching for housing just big enough for the three of them. But that is, of course, when Grandma Inez announced that she was pregnant. And Aunt Trudy said, oh, and of course she was pregnant with twins. And so, as you know, they went ahead and moved up into Overwhelm. And the family had a common story back then. Everyone in the family was working multiple back-breaking jobs, desperately trying to make ends meet. I mean, the 10-year-old boy was working multiple jobs. The pregnant mother was working multiple jobs. The father was working multiple. They were all just working so hard just to survive. On Friday nights, they would finish dinner, clear the table. And then what they would do is they would sit around the table and they would hand roll artisanal prank relighting birthday candles and sell them at the markets on Saturdays. They would all sit around and hand roll artisanal prank relighting birthday candles and sell them at the markets. And y'all, you never know what's going to catch on, because those prank relighting birthday candles started selling out by 11 o'clock in the morning at the market. People started ordering those artisanal hand rolled prank relighting birthday candles from far, far away places. It didn't take long before Grandpa Joe got a bunch of investors together. They started a small factory over in Nottopun. And within 18 months, the family was out of debt, y'all. Within 2.5 years, they were financially stable. That is a thing almost no families could say at that time. It is a true success story. Until Aunt Trudy said, oh, well, what happened, babies? One night, a September night, that candle factory in Nottopun caught fire. And the fire department put it all out, but then it just relit. And they put it out again, it just relit. And they put it out again, it just relit. I mean, you got to give it to Grandpa Joe. Them candles were good. And back then, insurance was not required for small businesses. They lost everything. Aunt Trudy said, oh, honey, I mean, if that would have happened today, the way that building burnt down, we'd have been able to collect the insurance money 3.5 times. Who knows what would have happened had that candle factory burnt down, not burnt down. Maybe I would have a little bit of money. Who knows? But Aunt Trudy knows what's important. She told me, she said, see, that's the thing, honey. I don't care that your Uncle Fultz and I've had to get so creative in order to retire. It doesn't matter to me at all. What matters is that you are here, Paul, to share these stories, these the one-abouts, with your Uncle Fultz and me. That's the thing about stories. When the light of a story goes out in one person, it almost always finds a way to relight in somebody else. And just like them quarters we were talking about earlier, stories are so much more valuable years from now than they are today. So, Paul, I want you to take that the one about that you have in your hand there, and under the crossed out name of my granddaddy, and the crossed out name of my daddy, and the crossed out name of my grandmama, I want you to write your name, Paul, under my name. Because that way, you'll be able to share this story with people too. But honey, do me a favor. Don't cross out my name just yet. I really hope I get to tell this story a few more times.
Paul Strickland with The Oneabouts, a parable of sorts about the power that sharing stories can have. I'm fond of saying that while not every story needs a moral, every story needs a reason. And I asked Paul to talk just a little bit about the reason for that story, to say something about what the story is for. And here's what he told me.
The fact is, people want to retell stories whenever they have a connection to it because they want to connect with other people, with themselves. The story is just the vehicle. That's what the Oneabouts is all about, is just being a vehicle so that people can connect to each other.
Paul Strickland talking about stories as vehicles for connection between people. It's the connection that's important, and sharing stories helps make and hold that connection. And there's a chance that after hearing Paul's story, you're thinking of a few one-about stories of your own. I know that's what's happened to me. And right now I'm thinking of the one about the walnut shell. And I'll tell you that story. But before I do, I gotta say that when it comes to building a family culture of telling stories together, I've always believed that important objects are a great trigger to get memories going. I know that sometimes if someone says, "Tell me a story," it's kind of easy to draw a blank. But if someone says, "Hey, tell me about that old baseball on your desk," or, "Hey, tell me about the first car you ever drove," or even, "Hey, when was this photo on the wall taken?" The baseball or the car or the photo can open a box of stories worth hearing. As for the walnut shell, here's the story. My grandmother, after a good long life, passed away. This was way back in the 1990s. And my grandfather was very old then, but he was still with us. And one day in the weeks after Grandma's passing, I went into my grandfather's bedroom to see him sitting on the edge of the bed and holding in his hand what I at first thought was just a little round wooden ball. But it was actually a whole walnut shell, just the shell, no nut inside it. The two halves of the shell fit together perfectly like a little box. And I looked even more closely, and I saw that someone had drawn on the outside of the walnut shell with a black pen. They had drawn a little face, a wrinkly little walnut shell guy face. And I asked my grandpa to tell me about that walnut shell. And I didn't figure there was much of a story there, but I was wrong. The walnut shell he was holding in his hand was more than 60 years old. In those days, more than 60 years ago, he was falling in love with my grandmother and had prepared a gift of love for her, a beautiful ruby ring that he'd saved up and bought. And as a little joke, he had hollowed out a walnut shell and drawn a face on it and given her the ring inside that shell instead of using a regular ring box. Now, I knew the ring. Grandma had worn it until the day she died. And my grandpa wore one a lot like it. He was wearing it even as I was watching him holding that walnut shell. But hearing the story about the walnut shell brought into vivid focus for me not the old man and the old woman that I knew so well, but the kids, those two kids who would become my grandparents, those two kids full of jokes and laughs and dreams for the future, kids who might get a kick out of a ring delivered in a walnut shell, and even some of the poetry of my grandpa's little joke. I imagined him saying with that gift, "Love me now, and love me when I'm old and small and wrinkled like this walnut shell." And I imagine my young grandmother, the girl I never knew in real life, laughing through happy tears. That little walnut shell wasn't empty at all, it turns out. The one about the walnut shell was really the one about Leland and Maxine Payne, my grandparents, and their lives together. And getting at that story was as simple as saying, "Hey, Grandpa, tell me about that walnut shell." Little objects can trigger big stories. Find a little object in your world that you'd like to know more about and ask, and watch the stories come to life. That's where Paul's story took me. Where did the story take you? And who will you take along? There's a lot more coming up, but I wanted to introduce you to another show from among the BYU Radio family of podcasts. The show is called In Good Faith, and it's a podcast in which host Stephen Cap
Perry talks with a different person in every episode about their walk of faith, their faith tradition, their relationship with the divine. And whether you want to strengthen your own faith or just listen to thoughtful conversations about religion and about a walk of faith with a terrific listener, that's Stephen Capp Perry and In Good Faith. You can find it on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or YouTube, all kinds of ways to listen to In Good Faith whenever you like, whenever you need it. It's another great podcast from BYU Radio. It's such a pleasure to be with you on today's episode of The Appleseed, and it's time for another story. This one comes from Carolina Quiroga Stultz, a storyteller who lives in the United States now, but didn't always. And this is a story called A Biscuit Story. It's the one about how Carolina came to feel at home in a new place. Here's Carolina, recorded live before a terrific Appleseed studio audience.
On January the 6th, 2012, I arrived in the United States to do a master's in storytelling at East Tennessee State University in Johnson City, Tennessee. Why? Because the year before, I entered the crisis of the 30s. Yeah. My original plan was to go to Nepal, catch up with wisdom, flirt with my purpose, and eventually find a place I could call home. A friend of mine said, Carolina, estás loca. Now, there was nothing wrong with Cali, Colombia, the place where I am from. Cali is a beautiful, hot, diverse city, the capital of salsa and plastic surgery. Ruled by the Cali cartel during the 80s and 90s, also known as the Gentleman Cartel, if you watch Narcos, the series. So I grew up with the burden of being from a very dangerous place, single out at airports, and sometimes, you know, the usual question, are you carrying any drugs? Now, that first week when I was in college at ETSU, they gathered all the international students to welcome us and to let us know that we could be experiencing something called cultural shock. And I thought, that's never gonna happen to me. I'm a Sagittarius. I mean, I'm the sign of adventure and freedom. Nope, I didn't fit in. The first 3 months, I was so sad that I just wanted to go back home. I almost purchased the ticket to go back home twice. But the first time, I met an Indian woman at the bus stop on campus, and she asked me, where are you from? Colombia. So you dance salsa? Yes. Oh, would you like to join me doing an Indian dance for the Multicultural Day? So random invitations like this is what kept me in school for the first year. And if you're wondering how the dance went, well, it was so much of a hit that people thought I was Indian for a whole year. Yeah. So among the things I struggled the most was the cold weather, because it represented the opposite of everything that was familiar and dear to me. I also struggled with the Tennessean accent because it's not the way Friends, the TV show, talks. And when you're an immigrant, you do watch those comedies to practice your English. But the long-lasting struggles that really, really affected me were pretty much the food and the stories told. Allow me to elaborate. I attended many festivals, storytelling festivals, and I noticed that there is a particular tale that the audience favor. And it is that that talks about the good old days, when America was great, when folks were decent, life was simple, and they were all on the same page. These are stories that filled tents, invoked tender family moments, full of olfactory sensations when freshly baked goods were pulled out of the oven. The audience would go, ah, and they would nod their heads in approval. These stories were like gospel, so I called them biscuit stories. As a foreign teller trying to share the beauty of my cultures, those biscuit stories resemble a bubble world, self-centered, and somehow holding on to a buttery past. And we eat a lot of grease in Colombia, but still. So I pushed harder. My entire repertoire became about Latin America. I even launched a podcast. Because when you experience pushback, you become an ambassador or a defender of your culture. And then I declared war on biscuits. And I refused to eat them. But I've been living in the South for 12 years, so it's been hard. Thankfully, my husband's generous belly took on the burden, you know, of eating them just to avoid the question, "Oh, honey, you didn't like your biscuits." But please don't be upset. I know some people get patriotic with their food, but there's more to the story. The stereotypical Latina cooks. It's in her DNA. It's a skill passed from abuela to mama to hija, the subtle art of being una buena ama de casa, a good housewife. Not me. My mother never taught me how to cook. Instead, she chased me out of the kitchen every time I pop in. Why? It remains a mystery. Was there some sort of sleeping beauty curse if I dared to touch a kitchen utensil before the age of 21? I don't know. And to aggravate my cooking orphan situation, both mis abuelas, my grandmothers, lived far away. So I did not grow up learning any traditional Colombian dishes from any mother figure. And guess what? I was not too sad about it. Because I'm terrible at following instructions. Like that one time when I added a whole cup of salt to a pasta pesto recipe. Mm-hmm. And to even it out, I added half a cup of sugar. It didn't work, but we ate it. And we spent the whole night dehydrated. Yep. But in every story, there's always an until. In 2022, my husband took a sabbatical year and we sold our home and we moved back to Johnson City, Tennessee to live with his brother and his grandmother. Doris is the most stylish 94-year-old lady. She wears makeup that makes her look in her 50s. That's a big accomplishment. Her house resembles a European castle. She's tall, fair, slim, despite her unyielding desire to eat biscuits from Bojangles once a week. Unfortunately, her health had been declining over the years, yet the several falls and trips to the ER did not affect her humor and grace. But it was just a matter of time for her family to announce that they were moving her to a retirement home. And the news came when my husband and I were relocating to North Carolina. Doris kept her cool, and she became more unyielding in her desire to cook. I understood that cooking meant much more to her than it meant to us. It reminded her of her good old days, of the numerous Thanksgivings, of her motherhood, of the strength she had to gather when her husband passed away, of when she had to become a businesswoman at the age of 50, and she did it for 30 years. Somehow all those memories were in those pots, in those meals. So one day, with no warning, she began pulling out pots and pans out. My husband and his brother were away, so when I came into the kitchen, I reluctantly asked, "Do you need help?" Like the boss she had been, she began instructing me on what to do, and it was easy to follow because in between, she told me stories. And like many other times, she told me she loved me like I was one of her own. That night, the four of us came together for one last meal with her. And after chatting for a while, Doris noticed that I hadn't touched my biscuit. She asked, "Carolina, you didn't like your biscuit." I said, "I'm full, Doris, but thank you, though." She insisted. Knowing that this was important to her, I took a bite, while my husband looked at me horrified, thinking I would choke. But I didn't. That biscuit was emotionally tasty, because for the first time, I had a fond memory of cooking with a grandma. And although this country welcomed me all right, I never felt rooted. I was always the immigrant, until that meal with my new family. And in the words of a friend, Carolina, Johnson City was your Nepal. So I guess I finally have a biscuit story to tell. And the war, it's over. Thank you.
Carolina Quiroga Stultz with a tale called A Biscuit Story. After hearing Paul's story and Carolina's, what are some of the one-about thoughts you're having? What are the stories you work to remember and share about your own life or the life of your family? Is there an important object on your desk or on a bookshelf or a mantle or a windowsill somewhere in your world that can spark a memory that ought to be shared as a story? Thanks to Paul Strickland and Carolina Quiroga Stultz for their tales today. You've listened to their stories, and now it's your turn to share some of your own. The Appleseed is produced by me, Sam Payne, Wendy Folsom, and Brian Tanner. Our audio engineers are Ashton Parkinson and DJ Cromarty. The rest of the Appleseed team, Kira Van Dam, Kelly Wormeister, Tristan Schetzel, Kay Hendricks, and Nico Wetzel. Hey, if you like today's podcast, subscribe, rate us, leave us a review, and tell your friends. That's how the podcast grows. We also love to receive emails. Email us at theappleseed@byu.edu. That's theappleseed, all one word, at byu.edu. Your thoughts and comments help us shape the future of the Appleseed. We're pleased and proud to be among the many podcasts produced by the BYU Radio family of shows. If you want more great storytelling for the whole family, then search for our companion podcast, Kaboom, where you'll hear original audio adventures for the whole family. You can find any episode of The Appleseed or Kaboom on YouTube, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, on the BYU Radio app, or at byuradio.org. I'm Sam Payne, and we can't wait to be with you again on The Appleseed.